If you are just joining us, you just heard John Morton, who is a retired supervisory biologist at the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge. We've also got Rick Johnston, a retired refuge law enforcement officer, pilot, ranger, and extensively has worked with developing the permit program at the refuge. And we've also got David Raskin, who is president of Friends of Alaska National Wildlife Refuges. I'm Jenny Nyman, and you are listening to the Kenai Conversation, and we're talking about the proposed rule changes. We're in the comment period at the moment for some, as you just heard John describe, changes to regulations on the refuge. Maybe we can start digging into some of these specifics. So, Rick or John, I'm not sure which one wants to take this one, but I would imagine the trapping is certainly one of the more controversial changes. Rick, you did a little bit of this, but what exactly the refuge permit is now, and then what would change if this proposal goes into effect? So specifically the trapper education class you have to take, the setbacks, that kind of stuff.
The refuge trapping permit established, several best practices. These common practices, and they're used in different areas of the country, that was pretty extensively reviewed by several refuge staff, back in the early mid 80s. And one of the things that it requires is as opposed to being able to just go along the road and put your sets out along the road or in recreation areas along the nature trail, so on and so forth, places where there's more potential for conflict, which really doesn't serve anybody. It's basically a trapper, is kind of pick his area and have a kind of a trailhead or kind of a headquarters there at the road, and then they work their trap line in from there. They also may, fly in. But we're talking there about just having a roadside buffer. It allows beavers and other wildlife to, be less targeted close to those road areas so the other users can, have an opportunity to have a little bit less harvest and, kind of see that. But it also...
And what currently is that setback distance?
It's 1 mile. It was originally, I think, a little greater.
It used to be like 2 miles, I want to say,
think that
right?
It was like there was an area around recreation areas that was larger. And then there was the setback along the road. So now, before you kind of set your first traps, you've got to be a little ways in on your trap line.
Right.
And one of the biggest problems that they were trying to solve with this trapping permit from years ago was this thing I mentioned to you before, where you had a lot of people trapping on top of each other. There really no incentive to husband or farm that area. It'd be like if 10 farmers were trying to plow the same field, basically, and using exclusive areas is a very common thing, particularly in the Canadian Northern Territories and remote areas. And the state of Alaska really resisted that when we were having our collaborative process in the 80s. And the compromise, and there was many compromises both ways, was to kind of have this buffer thing. So sure, two people could randomly actually pick the same trail system or area that they go, but by having that setback, it just kind of more dispersed and kind of randomized where different people were, setting their areas. And a lot of times trappers go back to the same area, and both the state and the refuge advisory and regulatory perspectives in their programs ask other trappers to respect traditional areas. But that idea, that exclusive thing, the state really resisted that. The refuge thought it would be the best way to establish more of a husbandry, more of a sustained yield, where there was that incentive to do a good job managing your trap zone, so there'd be more fur for future years. But the refuge went with this buffer area.
Another good reason that for the setbacks, it certainly has been brought up to the Board of Game on several occasions as far as minimizing conflicts with other trail users, specifically dog walkers, right?
I just want to jump in there too and make sure that we're clarifying. It's not the buffer that we're talking about, the prohibition of trapping. It's specifically within 1 mile of road accessible trailheads.
Right.
So it's not the entire trail; it's the trailhead. And again, it's road accessible trailheads, public roads, 1 mile within public recreational facilities. And then it's very specifically, what's mentioned in there is refuge headquarters and visitor center. Right now, obviously, we don't have any trapping up there. We don't even allow dogs up there.
Right.
But in the future, if this were to come into place, if you walk your dog up there on Ski Lack along, you know, along Ski Hill Road, or want to go out and ski in the refuge, then you have to start thinking about traps.
Well, they're really, you really can't talk to too many people over, they'll say, that who've had dogs, or, you know, friends have had dogs, or, you know, teenage kid that's had a dog that hasn't had a conflict with traps. That continues, and it's kind of a source of contention between trappers and non-trappers. And I think the refuge took this perspective that, hey, you know, we're a wildlife refuge, and we have to write a compatibility determination by law. We can implement a program that hopefully it doesn't impede the trappers in their pursuit of getting, you know, the fur that they're seeking, and also reduces these conflicts. It's only common sense to try to reduce those conflicts, because it doesn't serve the trappers well at all to have a lot of angry people that, you know, just do not appreciate them being there, sharing the same area. And I think the really test here is that all the conflict discussions that were going on in the late 70s, early mid-80s, we've gone for almost 30, maybe closer to 40 years here, without a lot of problems. But there's a bee in the bonnet, a burr in the saddle of the state, that these regulations were implemented in. So they have this opportunity right now, in a very rote political move, to go in and change this without the accompanying peer-reviewed literature, without the accompanying environmental documents that justify this regulation. And I'm sure there's a lot of former refuge managers that have heard about this that can't hardly believe their ears, that they're actually trying to take us back to about, you know, 1950 in terms of regulations. And, you know, I don't like to say negative things about my state friends, but the State of Alaska Trapping Program, the State of Alaska Trapping Regulatory Book I have in my hand here, is as near skeletal and nothing as of almost any state in the union in terms of it's, it just kind of leaves it all up to kind of seat of the pants feel, the trapper ethics and stuff. And that works in some instances. There are many years when we had 50 to 100 trappers on the refuge, and there was two or three of those trappers who were old-time trappers who, you know, got out their snowshoes or their airplane. They went into remote areas, and they were very successful. And they actually caught about 70, you know, or I'm just using a general figure, but they caught a big, substantial amount of the fur. And we never had these legal issues with catching non-target species like bald eagles, or catching fur out of season, because they knew that doing it, you know, in a wise way was the best way to make money at it, too. And what happened was, as you got an increasingly urban group of people, an increasingly busy refuge, many of the illegal incidents that I came across before or after the refuge implementation of the permit, before it was hard to get accountability because the traps didn't have to be marked or identified. Afterwards, it was a little easier. But a common violation would have a set of traps that still had the Sportsman's Warehouse or Walmart sticker on them. They weren't going to catch much fur they were targeting. What they were catching was bald eagles by the pinky, and then not checking their traps on time, and, you know, and not even being able to release the that is not you know, what an old-time trapper would think was a good thing, you know.
Well,
good thing.
As you say, I mean, it certainly does not behoove trappers to behave poorly and give themselves a black eye, especially with
absolutely
more, and, you know, this issue comes up more and more
and
frequently.
It's not very, and more importantly, it's not very successful to do it wrong.
Yeah, and so it's really tough for the, and I know the Trappers Association and folks involved in that have had a really hard time with this one, too, because they certainly want to do it ethically and, as you say, effectively. What's the point of trapping if you're not going to be successful at it? And then there's this, you know, as you say, there's some bad apples, some bad actors, whatnot, that might be, as interest in these lands and participation grows and grows and population grows and grows, more and more people get into something and maybe they don't put the time and the effort and the experience and the knowledge into it as some other folks do, and then you end up with a situation we're in now where there are more conflicts. And, you know, on one hand, trappers have had the ability to do this. You look like you want to jump in here.
Yeah, I just kind of wanted to riff it off of Rick's comment about, you know, the urban trapper, and you're commenting about the number of people that are here. I mean, and I'm kind of backing it up just a little bit, not drilling so much into some of the specifics of the fur trapping program here. But, you know, the issue from my perspective, and I think most of the refuge employees currently think this way, is that, you know, the Kenai Refuge is Alaska's equivalent of an urban refuge in the lower 48, right? I mean, we've got lots of people here that are using this place. We've got, you know, 20-something miles of highway that run down, you know, down the highway, down, the, you know, that bisect the refuge. We've got commercial oil and gas development. We've got, you know, 60,000 people that live on the Kenai Peninsula that are actively using and enjoying the refuge and other federal lands. My point being is that this is an urbanizing landscape. And so we have to manage this in a slightly different way than, say, you might manage Eisenbeck Refuge or something like that, right? And so that's the reason why the refuge needs to have the ability to have slightly tighter regulations here, and we can't go with statewide regulations because it's, you know, it just doesn't make sense. We just got lots of people running around here.
Well, and the state, Rick, is, as you're pointing out, they have the, I think they call it Trapper Code of Ethics, and in the reg book for that, they list all the things that you're talking about. You know, don't trap on top of each other. Be respectful of other users of an area. Seek to, you know, trap in a way that minimizes conflict. All the stuff that you are recommending is what the state recommends as well. The difference is whether or not it's required.
Exactly. And also whether there's accountability.
Jenny, this is David. I'd like to just sort of add a little historical and political perspective on this, too, that we've talked about how there's a long history of cooperation between the state fish and game and the refuge. And this persisted for a long time. And the current regulations, not the ones that are proposed, were adopted in 2016 after a very extensive public process and a lot of back and forth with the state fish and game, and those were then adopted in 2016. But then we had a change of administration, and in January 2017, after the new federal administration came in, the state and the Safari Club International and a group of Alaska hunters sued the state, the Fish and Wildlife Service, to try to overturn those regulations. And interestingly, now, after the state election and the current governor, the Department of Fish and Game is headed by former officials of Safari Club International that are still party to the suit against the Fish and Wildlife Service. So you have the director, the commissioner of Fish and Game, the deputy commissioner of Fish and Game, and the person involved with conservation of wildlife. All three come from Safari Club International, which is the group that started this whole process in 2017 to try to overturn the refuge's legal requirements to manage all of this.
Is there anything else on the trapping change that we should hit on? There's a couple others we should discuss, too, and we're getting a little short on time.
I know. So I just wanted to mention that just, you know, to have the complete package out there so people know what they're looking for. So when we talk about eliminating the refuge's fur bear trapping program, what we're talking about is getting rid. Right now, we have a one-time refuge-sponsored trapper orientation course that's offered every October for every permitted, trapper permitted on the refuge. And it's only a one-time deal. Once you've done it, you don't have to do it again. That would be eliminated. Right now, we have we require identification of all traps and snares so that we can push the accountability issue, and that would be eliminated. We currently, on the refuge, requires checking of all leg hole traps and snares every 4 days if it's an accessible area, or 7 days if it's a remote area. And again, that's to make sure that animals are retrieved in a timely way. It improves fur value. But the other piece of it, of course, is that we don't have animals languishing out there that are being hurt. One of the big ones is right now we have prohibit traps and snares within 30 feet of any site-exposed bait. And what that's all about is preventing take of things like eagles, right? You don't want eagles coming down and landing on something that has a trap on it. We already mentioned the prohibition of the trapping within the 1 mile buffer around accessible trailheads. And then the last one is we have special restrictions in place on the refuge for four species. We have it for lynx, we have it for beaver, we have it for American marten, and we have it for red fox. And I don't need to say specifically what they are, but, you know, again, it's the refuge is trying to manage, you know, the populations that it has more conservatively.
There's one other thing that when I was visiting a retired the biologist was in John's former position, was involved in these trapping regulations, and he emphasized this. And he, you know, like the trapping manual of the state says trapping in a humane way. And an example of that on the existing trapping permit is there would no longer be humane trapping requirements on the refuge, such as leg hold, body grip, and drowning trap check requirements, and also trap types. Like, for example, some traps are like a smooth jaws.
Right.
And they hold the target species, but if there's, say, let's say it's lynx is out of season, but it's caught in a coyote trap, you can open it up properly, you know, a knowledgeable trapper can, and hopefully let that non-target species go, or an eagle, for that, you know, in a humane way. But if it's a serrated, you know, kind of a tooth trap, like we've all seen in the Hollywood movies, uh-huh. like the big old-fashioned bear traps, that it causes such damage that it's hard to for the trapper to actually release a, you know, something that isn't mortally injured and stuff. And so there's an example there where the refuge trapping permit actually give some guidance and definition and fleshes out what's humane, where the state permit says just trap in a humane way. And I think that's an important distinction.
Okay, John, which one should we go to next? You know, I've always been curious about the bike issue. What has the justification been for not allowing bikes?
Yeah, I wrote, you know, I'm a big biker. I love biking. And I actually wrote a Refuge Notebook article several years ago exploring that whole piece there. And what this is you got to remember, I mean, the Kenai Refuge is part of a much larger system. You know, it's a national refuge system, right? And the kind of the lower 48 perspective on bikes is that you don't do that for wildlife viewing. You do it primarily to go ride around on your bikes. And so in the lower 48, riding bikes is not considered, you know, one of the priorities of the refuge system. You know, again, the refuge system focuses on things like wildlife viewing, photography, and hunting and fishing. And bikes down there are not perceived to be part of that. But of course, the difference is up here in Alaska is we do use bikes for hunting and fishing. And we do use bikes, you know, fairly frequently, especially with the, you know, fat tire bikes now. I mean, you can go anywhere, right?
Yep.
And so that's why you see that sort of, it seems like a disconnect, but you got to just appreciate that as a national system, we have a perception of what bikes are, and we're here in Alaska, and so we have a slightly different view on it.
I think one thing I'd like to throw in, and it was always the elephant in the room in the discussion points over the 30 years or more that I was with the refuge, and that's this. It's like, so you have, an untrailed, unroaded National Wildlife Refuge, say, in, you know, 1941 when it was established and when the refuge manager first came. Then in the 50s, you had the discovery of oil and gas on the refuge. So there was a lot of pressure to open it up to oil and gas. Then there was utility companies that wanted to put utilities across the refuge. So when you, one of the arguing points, just like in Prudhoe Bay now, you've got this industrial encroachment, but then as advertised, they say, well, it's just going to be a temporary 30 or 40 year thing, then we're going to pull those roads out. But once a route is in there, there's whether it be for routes for Forest Service and logging on National Wildlife Refuges, whether it be oil and gas like the Swanson River oil field, whether it be utilities, then people start the secondary use, which is the access for walking. So the kind of think of the industrial roads on the refuge as trails. So people, you know, those have always been available, and they're certainly easier to walk on those trails to go hunting. Or in my case, I had horses for many years, and we would use the horses on Swanson River oil field or like Instar pipeline. But Then when you have bikes, you're introducing a method of travel that wouldn't have been possible, you know, if the industrial use hadn't got approval to go. So there's the impact of that, but then there's also the impact of those users, whether it be, you know, harrying or disturbing wildlife, which is kind of small. But you have to also realize that wherever you have those roads, those industrial roads open, you are also having a major access place for harvest, whether it be these trapping situations we've talked about, whether it be hunting or whatever. So is it fair chase to go along Mystery Creek Road in a quiet bicycle? I mean, at least a car coming, wildlife can hear the car, you know, and kind of maybe, you know, amble off the road or not, you know. But is a speedy bike going along the Resurrection Trail or Mystery Creek Road or any of the other industrial routes there, is that fair chase? And so what we're talking about is not just having that bike access for just sightseeing and so on and so forth. You're also having that bike access for moose hunting or black bear hunting. Then when you couple that with state of Alaska seasons that are sometimes extraordinarily long, or as we've talked about with some of these trapping things, you know, pretty laissez-faire, very liberal, you know, as far as the methods and means and so on and so forth. What you're saying is once you have that industrial road in there, from that time on with the bike access, you're going to have a high level of targeted access at that area. And so then it's just a decision, is that okay? And so I think over the years, the refuge mitigated that industrial access by just having to be, they mitigated that industrial access in some ways by just saying, okay, it's still open for trails. It can be used for the kinds of access that would have been otherwise available on a trail. It's like horse use. But a bicycle, at least in the old days, you know, for the fat bikes, it wouldn't have been kind of possible to use those or game carts. Or if game carts are allowed, how about a Conestoga wagon and six draft horses? Could you? So there's a lot of little subtle things. It's not just a bicycle sometimes, and it's not just a bicycle just for bicycling. There's other harvest issues to it too. So it's something that the refuge, I don't know, I have an opinion one way or the other about some of these new biking things, but you have to realize that if you have bicycles on those roads and it also is allowed for hunting, you're changing a significant hunting opportunity. You know, you're competing now with the people that got to use it for horses. You're also competing with people that use it just to walk in and use it as a trail.
Okay, John, we got about 10 minutes left. What else on that list should we delve into a little deeper?
With the short time here, I don't want to lose sight of the taking brown bears over black bear.
Right, and so, sites. Of course, taking black bear over bait has and continues to be allowed on the refuge, but brown bear not.
That's right. So, you know, there's so many facets to this. I mean, in the immediate sense, what we're talking about is there is a difference between black bears and brown bears in the sense that black bears, by most people, they eat them, right? And the difference with brown bears is you don't. And
You're still, just to be fair, though, if you're taking a brown bear in the state of Alaska, you're still required to salvage, right?
No, and as of 2016-17, that's no longer the case.
Oh, okay.
So essentially, what we're kind of sanctioning here is the take of brown bear over bait, almost for trophy purposes, right? And that just doesn't fly well with what a federal refuge is all about. A National Wildlife Refuge is about wildlife. And so this is, almost from an ethical perspective, this is a tough one for us to, and when I say us, I guess I mean the refuge. I'm still us. It's only been 6 months, so I'm still struggling a little bit with that.
Recently retired, yes. Syndrome over here.
Keep in mind that hunting programs, including the bear baiting program, and full disclosure, when I first came on with the refuge, say in the 80s and also the state, baiting for black bears just was not, common. It was also against national rules. When it was one other state, I think it was Michigan and Alaska, changed the rules where you could, hunt over bait. Well, then the Kenai still prohibited it, but there was a lot of political pressure to comply. There was other people who said, this is a no-brainer. This isn't compatible on the refuge. You're going to habituate, lots of bears to garbage and stuff. This is clearly a conflict, but there really wasn't politically an option not to have it. So we established a program that at least kept it out of wilderness and did some square mile areas so we wouldn't have this tragedy, the commons thing I was talking about, where you have like 10 bait stations in one area. But believe me, when Robin when we first did the bear baiting program, we're supposed to do compatibility determinations. There was a political decision made not to try to write a compatibility determination for baiting on this National Wildlife Refuge, probably because it looked absurd, frankly, that it would be compatible. And so they just did a compatibility determination for hunting in general, and the refuge really gave a solid to the state there by allowing the program to start with, even if it was with a permit. And so Robin West, I believe it was about 2010.
Former refuge manager.
Yep. Robin West. A little bit more, I would just say a little more friendly to harvest programs and state issues than maybe some other managers. But he wrote compatibility determination, which I have right in front of me here. And it when I look at this permit, and I had a tremendous respect for Robin West, but still, he had to twist himself in pretzels to write this as a positive compatibility determination. But then again, at what point does a straw break the camel's back? And I would argue that brown bear baiting added to this permit, it's I could clearly, if I was an environmental attorney, I could clearly make a non-compatibility at least argument that bear baiting with this added harvestability. And there's already a lot of refuge bears being harvested over bait at adjacent stations, but it's I think that the brown bear baiting with a potential for increased harvest, and John can speak to that a little bit, I think it's just a bridge too far, and that's my concern about it.
I would love to jump in there. There's a larger issue here besides the immediate baiting, and that's the issue of conservation of Kenai brown bears. And, until 2012, the state, ADF&G, considered brown bear populations on the Kenai Peninsula a species of special concern. And all of a sudden in 2012, they kind of wave it away.
Well, the population estimate changed.
Well, the population estimate changed a little bit, and so we went from a very conservative management approach to all of a sudden we jumped up, and in between 2012 and 2014, over 200 bears were killed, and through a very liberalized effort by the Board of Game.
And that's since been scaled back.
It's been scaled back a little bit, but part of the reason why we haven't reached the cap in the last 5 years, there's a lot of people that really strongly believe that there just aren't as many bears out there anymore, and that's why it's very difficult to reach the cap that the Board of Game set. So there is a true conservation concern. And right now the refuge functions like what it's supposed to be. The very term refuge, we are a refugia, and we offer that. And there's brown bear baiting over on Chugach National Forest and on private lands outside of the refuge. So you've got all of this extra harvesting going on that, is fairly recent, of taking brown bear over bait. And if we open that door, the concern we have on the refuge, of course, is if you open that door on the refuge, then you've really started cropping into some of your bears that are most fecund and produced, on a year-to-year basis.
To be fair, though, that's not to say that there aren't going to be any regulations about harvest. I mean, certainly the state of Alaska, they close the season when X number of bears have been taken. So I certainly understand your point, but I don't want to make it sound like, well, all the bears are going to be taken.
Well,
now,
except that there's a really, very, very good paper that was published in the journal Ursus in 2017. And that was really, and what it was written by Sterling Miller, by Chuck Schwartz, and by John Shane. And these are all three of these are former ADF&G bear biologists. And all three of them have said in this paper that the Board of Game and the state of Alaska have liberalized regulations for brown bear harvest in the state to the point that it's almost a form of predator control. So I respectfully disagree that the state may rein this in.
My point being that there are still limits on bear hunting, and I don't want someone who isn't familiar with the state Board of Game process to think that if this goes away on the refuge, an unlimited amount of bears can be taken. That's more what I was speaking to.
Fair enough.
Okay. Is there anything else? We got about three, four minutes left, John. Is there anything else on there that bears a little extra information?
Not tremendously. You know, again, we haven't really touched. There's the business about the prohibition of firearm discharge, you know, quarter mile.
Right. And so what, I mean, because that's beyond like moose season, for instance, that seasonal reopening of that. So what functionally would that look like if that one were to go through?
You know, again, the whole reason it was put into place to begin with was because there's so many user groups up on the upper Kenai River and Russian River. I mean, there's so many folks that are doing wildlife viewing, stopping along the road. There's people rafting. There's people fishing and angling. And so that was the original reason why it was put into place in 2016.
Right. And refresh us the season that this is going to change.
So now the proposal is to make it a seasonal closure. So it'd still be closed during the summer, but would be open from November 1 to April 30th.
Which would be
the wintertime.
Is that, but as far as purposes for firearms discharge, is that for like wolf hunting? I mean, why would people be out there discharging firearms in that time of year?
In that time period, if anybody's out discharging, I mean, there still is, isn't there some late season hunting?
Yes.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah.
And also keep in mind that, the state of Alaska allows discharge of firearms for otherwise species that are open on the trapping permit. In other words, like you don't have to, have hardware at all. You can basically, like I think in 15A, there's no limit on wolves, for example. So you could shoot as many wolves as you want to in that time of season, you know, adjacent to the highway there. So, and sure, there's not as much use on that particular area in the winter, or you know, after November than there is in the summertime, but there's that section there, and part of the reason for that discharge firearm was the Sterling Highways right there. And there's also a lot of say subadult bears that are coming in there in the summertime and are still kind of out in November, and I think maybe there's probably a little less harvest of some of those viewable wildlife along the river, which is a significant economic factor to have. You know, it's not unreasonable on a National Wildlife Refuge to expect to see a bear now and then. I certainly
especially driving Skelack Lake Road, yeah. And there's a good chance of that. All right, well, we are going to have to leave it there. That is the end of the hour. Thank you so much to David Raskin, President, Friends of Alaska National Wildlife Refuges, John Morton, retired supervisory biologist with the refuge, and Rick Johnston, retired refuge law enforcement officer, pilot ranger, and a permit guru, I'm just going to say. All right, this has been the Kenai Conversation. You can find more about these proposed regulation changes on the refuge website. We will also link to that on KDLL. Thank you so much for tuning in. We're going to return you to your regular programming. I'm Jenny Nyman, and this is listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula.